The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Okay. So, good evening. And what I'd like to do this evening and for the next two Monday evenings that I'm here is to talk about concentration. I won't be here in 2 weeks, May 14th, but we'll pick it up for the last talk of this three-part series on the 21st. So concentration is a very important element in the practice of meditation. It's also a very important quality of mind or quality of being, state of being, that is very supportive and helpful in daily life as well. Many of the things we do in our life can be done much better if we're centered when we do it, if we have we're stable inner stability when we do it, when we're gathered together, we're unified around what we're doing. And so in meditation practice, this is often emphasized, the importance of it. It's a very important partner together with mindfulness. People who like to do mindfulness practices, which is what we're mostly about here at IMC, the mindfulness practice is much more effective, much more satisfying when there is a strong level of concentration as part of it. The word concentration in Pali and Sanskrit is samadhi, and it's usually translated as concentration, but it's probably not the best translation. Maybe one reason is that concentration in many people's English-speaking minds sometimes is associated with one-pointed concentration, as if there's a laser someplace in the control tower and you're going to kind of zero in with your attention kind of and be very, very kind of one-pointedly focused. And so people who that kind of idea will often start straining and will often, sometimes even to the point of getting a headache, but often straining in a way that's not conducive for the cultivation of samadhi. Some of the words that I associate with samadhi are things like to be stable, stability, being centered, stillness, tranquility, deep relaxation. And one of the beautiful words that they use in the Buddhist language is unification or integration, a gathering together of the different fragmented aspects of the mind and body. The word samadhi also, some people when they hear the word concentration, think of it as just like a mental quality, something you do with your mind get concentrated. But the word samadhi is usually used in Buddhist language and Indian languages more as a state of being than it is a particular functioning of the mind. So if you're only trying to kind of gather together your mind in a particular way and that's the focus, then you might also miss how deeply satisfying samadhi can be, because it's a whole state that you enter into. So, and the word samadhi in Indian languages has a much broader meaning than concentration. Not only is it it's a whole series of states that are often considered almost sacred or sacred in Indian religions. There's many things which are called samadhis. There's Indian texts that have long lists of samadhis. You know, go on and on, pages and pages of kinds of samadhis that people have. So it's a very rich, evocative word. It's a very religious word in the context of Indian religions. And the English word that comes to mind to me that maybe is, I don't know if it's closest, but kind of, to me, kind of touches on the kind of religious quality or heartfeltness or kind of something deeper than just the word concentration, is the word communion. To be in communion with something has, I think, at least for me, has a rich association to it. It certainly is a religious word in Catholicism, Holy Communion. But to be in communion with something means not only that you're present, not only that you're aligned with something, but there's kind of an intimacy or connection or a deep sharing. I think communion sometimes means just kind of sharing. But I think it has a very rich associated feeling, emotional connection from some people, the word communion. So the word samadhi as well, I think it has, maybe communion a little bit works for samadhi, because sometimes samadhi does mean a kind of becoming one with the experience, becoming so intimate, so centered, absorbed in what you're focused on, that there's a kind of a deep communion, deep intimacy, deep disappearing of yourself as being separate from the experience that you're having, kind of a oneness with the experience. It might be interesting to consider a little bit the functions of samadhi in Buddhism, Buddhist practice. One of the primary functions is to create stability of mind. And so the analogy that I like to think of is that if you take a telescope and you're going to look at the moon and you hold a telescope in your hand, you probably can't hold it still enough to be able to keep it, you know, focused on the moon, because your hand isn't, you know, stable enough. But if you put the telescope on a tripod, then it can be still enough that once you kind of find the moon and keep it there, it'll stay there, and you can watch the moon for a while until the moon moves away, maybe. But you need to have that stability. So the same thing with our mind. If our mind is agitated, if the way we hold our mind is the mind is shaking, then we can't really focus on something with some kind of care, the kind of care that we need to really enter into the experience deeply and well to understand it. And so a part of the function of developing this concentrated state is so that the mind is no longer agitated, no longer spinning, or no longer jumping around from thought to thought, concern to concern, but can really feels like, you know, the mind is grounded, centered, at home in itself. So it's to create stability. Another function of samadhi is that it's quite healing for people. One of the things it heals is how we're fragmented from ourselves. We have a lot of fragmentation. Sometimes we're in conflict with ourselves, different parts of ourselves. It's really remarkable how some people live completely at war with different aspects of who they are. And sometimes the war, the inner war, just gets worse and worse, because if there's a part of themselves they don't like or they push away, then so they try to ignore it or push it away or deny it or be upset with it. That part feels actually awful. It doesn't feel good, right, for that part of you, but it's you, right? And so part of you is being treated poorly, but still you, so you feel bad. So sometimes people will push back against the part that's pushing against you. So these different parts of human beings can sometimes be at war with themselves. And part of the function of samadhi is to end the war, to end the conflict. To create this, what's called unification, this integration, so that there's no parts of ourselves which are left out, no part of ourselves which is pushed out or in conflict with. Sometimes the kind of healing that samadhi can provide is people can carry with them trauma. They can carry with them deep pain from experiences early in life. They can carry with them fear that is very deeply ingrained. There can be deeply, not just fear that kind of comes and goes, but there can be deep fear which is kind of pervasive in a person's way that they're aware of the world, how they register and know the world and know themselves. And that fear is an activity of the mind that once the mind begins to relax, it's hard to stay there. It's kind of certain things get overemphasized. Sometimes it can be we get one-sided because we get only focused on certain things. We get obsessed about certain things, obsessed on greed or obsessed on certain neuroses. And so one of the reasons why Buddhist teachers, meditation teachers, will instruct people in samadhi practice is when there's so much inner pain or so much inner fragmentation that you need to kind of heal it in order to be able to go further in the meditation practice. And so it's quite remarkable how healing samadhi can be for some people. A third function of samadhi is to provide a person with a deep abiding sense of well-being. Samadhi, states of samadhi, most of them, at least the ones that Buddhism tries to cultivate in people, it comes with feeling really good, a sense of well-being. Not only do you get feeling relaxed and peaceful to some degree, but there's levels of joy and happiness that bubble up, feelings of contentment, deep feelings of satisfaction, deep feelings of a very satisfying, meaningful, peaceful peace or tranquility. And not only is it, you know, it's not just a mental kind of satisfaction or happiness or joy, but it's something that you feel very much in your body. And so the body starts becoming more open or more integrated or unified or connected. When people live too much in their head, maybe always doing mental activity, like at work, or always on the computer, always watching TV, always avoiding themselves in some way or other, it's quite something, the fragmentation, the separation that people can have between their mind and their body. And sometimes that separation is quite dramatic. There are people who hardly experience anything below their neck or anything below their waist, sometimes because of trauma that they've had or difficulties they've had in their lives. Sometimes it's just because of the habit of always be thinking, and then people lose touch with themselves and how actually they feel. And so the stability and the relaxation of samadhi begins to open up that connection so that the mind and body are not so separate anymore, but operate together, experience together as a whole. And so part of the joy and the well-being of samadhi is also is physical, and part of it's mental. It's both. And so it feels very deeply satisfying. And so it's very nice. That's also one of the reasons why it's healing, to have this kind of joy and well-being. But it also becomes a very useful reference point in order to understand our life better. And so this is a fourth function of samadhi, is that when we have a deep sense of well-being and you value it, you think that you feel that's important and valuable, then perhaps when you start feeling, you start losing it, you get interested in what is going on now for me? Why am I losing it? Do I want to lose it? Is what I'm concerned about, what I'm getting caught up in, my anxiety or my concern, is it worth giving up the sense of well-being that I have? And it's really remarkable how much people are willing to give up their sense of well-being for the silliest reasons. I heard a talk recently by Joseph Goldstein, who's one of the first kind of pioneer Vipassana teachers in America. And he mentioned this talk how he was in early years of practice in India. He was practicing meditation on retreat, and the food in the temple in India where he practiced was pretty poor. But in the evening, they would sometimes serve some very, very small, he said, very small Indian bananas as the dinner. So he would be sitting there, sometimes feeling in deep samadhi, very happy, very contented, very concentrated, and feeling, oh, enlightenment is going to happen any time now. Like, you just feel it, it's close. I'm going to have this, there's something really beautiful and profound. My enlightenment's going to happen. And then he'd hear the dinner bell, the supper, you know. And then he had to decide, enlightenment or banana? Which will it be? And usually the banana won. So the people, we make all kinds of choices, and some of the choices are not for something as pleasant as a banana. But there's all kinds of reasons why people will lose their samadhi, their presence of mind, their mindfulness, because we get caught in all kinds of concerns. And some of them they're not even sweet. But to have the well-being and the stability and the calm of samadhi as a reference point helps to highlight when we start getting caught up, when we start getting anxious or tense. And then you have the, once you can start highlighting it, you can start questioning it. If you live your life always tense, you don't know you're tense. If you live your life always feeling kind of off or always feeling anxious or always feeling gloomy, you might assume that that's the way the universe was built. And then, you know, you don't think about it. It's just, it's so normal, part of your way of being. But part of the function of samadhi is to help you step out of your normal operating system, your normal mood, the normal feelings or emotions by which you're living by, when those aren't very healthy to live by. And maybe you've gotten so used to it. And it's hard, as probably all of you know, it's hard, you know, if you're feeling gloomy, it's hard to say, you know, let's not be gloomy, or, you know, let's not be sad, or let's not be whatever. But to have the ability to develop, to go into samadhi, pulls you out of that world and into a different world of well-being. And then you have a different a reference point for what's going on. And sometimes then people can see more clearly what happens that pulls them into their gloom, pulls them into their desire, pulls them into their fear, because of how radically different the state of mind samadhi can be. One of the, I think, powerful lessons of states of meditation that are satisfying and meaningful is to use them as, start to stay close in touch with them, and don't do anything that causes you to lose the kind of intimacy, the kind of well-being, the kind of connectedness that you feel in meditation when you leave meditation. Sometimes I think of that there's a certain kind of self-centeredness which is healthy. And the kind of self-centeredness that's healthy is a self-centeredness where you feel that you understand that it's useful and helpful for you and for others to stay close to and maintain joy, a sense of inner well-being, an inner sense of satisfaction in your body, mind, as you go through your life. A lot of people will say, "Well, that's selfish. Be so focused, you know, so focused on yourself." One of the beautiful things about samadhi is that when you develop strong concentration, right concentration, you can't be selfish. Because selfishness is a fragmentation. Selfishness is a kind of agitation. And as you develop deeper and deeper samadhi, deeper and deeper concentration, you have to let go of selfishness. So you let go of the selfishness, but you stay self-centered. What do you think of that? And here what I mean by self-centered is that you stay connected to yourself. Well, the center of your universe is here. Not your ego, not your self-identity, not your reputation, not your desires, but rather the situation that's here, with you here, your psychophysical experience at the center of it. And that psychophysical experience is an important part of your universe. Your whole universe arrives and departs from your psychophysical being. Nowhere else it can come and go from. So you're here. But if you're so caught up in your thoughts that you don't know where you're at, don't even know you have a body, then you've lost touch with your center of your universe. But to know where your body is and to feel a sense of well-being there and happiness, and to then, with that, enter the world. Enter the world not selfishly, but centered here on this, and you don't sacrifice it. You don't give it up. You don't give up the sense of being grounded and centered here and aware of what's going on in your belly and your chest and your arms and your hands and in your mind. And you stay with it and let the whole experience of the world be mediated through or come out of this sense of samadhi or well-being or happiness that's there. And if you do that well, you probably find that it's hard to stay, to be selfish. So here's, I think, one of the things, I believe one of the things that goes on when we develop samadhi. I haven't seen any studies about this, but I believe probably from everything I can learn from this phenomena, from reading about it, in modern literature, I think it must happen when people get concentrated in meditation, is the level of oxytocin goes up. And there's an article just today about oxytocin and how oxytocin helps create increased trust between people. The oxytocin is a very powerful chemical that the body releases, hormone, that probably human society is based on. You know, if mothers didn't release oxytocin into their blood system when they're nursing, the poor babies, because it makes the mothers feel very content and happy and satisfied and just so happy to be there and be present and, you know, not do something else, get impatient. You know, and oxytocin creates a wonderful sense of well-being. There have been studies that show that compassion elicits, brings oxytocin into the system. And part of the reason why healthy compassion can feel so good is because of the oxytocin that gets released. So I think the same thing happens in meditation, is that probably there's a deep sense of chemical change that goes on in the system. And so we can start feeling the sense of well-being that's there. So that kind of the kind of well-being that oxytocin produces is one that it makes it very hard for people to be selfish, but rather makes it much easier for people to be compassionate and caring and connected to the world. So the kind of self-centeredness that I'm talking about today is one that doesn't lead to selfishness, but actually I think leads to the opposite. But I use the word self-centered because of how it's kind of edgy word, I think, in our scene, right? You're not supposed to be self-centered. But to emphasize this thing about being centered here on yourself and to be in touch with what's going on. And if you've cultivated samadhi, then you can carry with you to some degree, not as dramatic in meditation, but you can carry with you into your life some of the feeling of well-being, some of the state of harmony or tranquility or relaxation that comes with it. Another function of samadhi is kind of the last one I'll mention now that kind of builds on all the earlier ones, is that because of the collectedness, because we've for right samadhi, right concentration in Buddhism, you can't be obsessive. So some people say, well, that person's really concentrated because they're obsessing about something. And there is a certain concentration, but then it's not, that concentration is not right concentration, because when you're obsessed, the mind is tense, it's caught, it's clinging to something. So with this deeper samadhi, there's a releasing of obsession, releasing of things we hold on to. There's a greater sense of well-being. That well-being then becomes a contrast to things, to other things that we search out for well-being. Some people who are addicted to certain substances and things because of the pleasure it provides will discover meditation and say, this is so much better. And sometimes it helps people let go of some kind of addiction, some kind of pleasure and well-being they're trying to get, because they know something so much better, meditation. So the releasing of obsession, the letting go, the sense of well-being, the joy, the tranquility, the peace, all those things together help the mind let go further. Help the mind release itself. Help the mind and the heart not be so shut down or contracted or clinging or tight. Begin the process of deeper and deeper opening up or relaxation or letting go or releasing the ways in which the heart is held tight or closed. And this is kind of the deepest aspect of Buddhist spirituality, is the possibility of a very deep and profound release of the heart or release of the mind, freedom. So I talked a little bit about, you know, a little bit, some of the idea that samadhi is a state that's related to things like tranquility and peace and unification, integration, stability, focus, centeredness. I talk now about some of the functions of samadhi, why it's considered so important. And so then the question is, how can you cultivate samadhi? How do you develop concentration? And that's some of the things I'll talk about over the next week, over the next talks. But something to say about samadhi, and about cultivating it, is the field, how to say it, the world of Buddhist practitioners, meditation practitioners, is strewn, is that a word? Strewn with people who have tried to get concentrated and failed. And it's, some of it's pretty ugly. And probably some of you here. And, you know, I'm one of those at times. You know, you try to get concentrated and just bear down more and, you know, just like, this is so important, I got to do it. And it's so, you know, because of the importance, you know, it's impossible. And so because you can't do it, I try harder. And so the harder you try, the further away it is. So the solution, of course, is to try harder. And it just, you know, I've my early years of meditation practice on retreat, I was digging my own grave. It was pretty bad. And, I would just feel completely miserable and have a headache and feel so bad about myself. I'm a meditation failure. Probably no one's ever failed before. And I mean, like, this is so, not even embarrassing. It's so much despair. And because it was so important, meditation, you know, and me, the meditator, was so important, and I was going to prove myself as being good at meditation. And, oh. And the only thing that helped in the end, the only thing that I knew that helped in the end, was to reach what seemed like just rock bottom and admit to myself it's hopeless and give up. And as soon as I gave, I was just hopeless, I can't do nothing. And I gave up, then, only then would something start developing. I'd start to get concentrated and settled and arrive. Because I had so much, you know, ego and so much effort and so much striving built in that I just kind of, it was ugly what happened. And I learned that you can't try too hard to get concentrated. It's one of those things that if you're going to try to master, you know, to be the best concentrator on the block, watch out. And in fact, what I've learned is it's best to be leisurely about it. Take your time. Don't be in a hurry. If you want to get concentrated fast, do it slowly. As soon as you try to do it fast, then it goes slow. So one of the important qualities then of concentration is to be relaxed. And in fact, relaxation for some teachers is almost synonymous with relaxation or calm. When I was doing my first Vipassana retreat in Thailand, I'd never done this style of meditation before. And I was meditating with I was under the supervision of a teacher who only spoke Thai. So I was getting my interviews with him translated. And at some point I was telling him that I would say, oh, in this last sitting, I got calm. And then would go to the translator and say it in Thai, and he'd come back, and the translator would say then back to English, say, oh, that's good, you're concentrated. And I said, no, you know, I'm not concentrated. And another day I would say, no, I'm concentrated, and I'd come back, oh, you're calm. And what was happening was that calm, and for that teacher, calm and concentration were considered synonyms or synonymous, the same. Even though for my understanding, the way I was experiencing, they were two different things, because there's many ways of experiencing these things. But so the point was is that relaxation and concentration are often seen very closely connected. And so if you can't get concentrated in a healthy way if you're tense. So it's very important to cultivate relaxation. And that's physical relaxation as well as mental relaxation. And so if you're measuring yourself every 2 seconds, see how concentrated you've gotten, you're not relaxed. If you're starting to strain and strain your muscles and your shoulders and your jaws and your eyes, which some people do, eyes are a particular place where people like to strain when they're trying to get concentrated. Because sometimes people associate concentration with looking more intently on something. I'm going to get concentrated on my breathing, and so I'm going to look at my breathing with more tight. And so, you know, any kind of tension just interferes with a healthy sense of developing concentration. So it helps to cultivate relaxation. And for some people, that's quite hard to cultivate that. So what I want to end this talk tonight about is that sometimes it's useful to not focus on developing concentration or samadhi directly, but rather to take care to cultivate or create the supporting conditions for samadhi or concentration. So rather than thinking, oh, just a mental quality, I have to do this thing with my mind so I can get concentrated, you create the supporting conditions so that you can relax, the mind gets settled and stable. And some of these supporting conditions are a big deal in Buddhism. And maybe it can't just be done just the snap of a finger because you hear it's a good idea. But maybe it takes some real deep inner reflection, searching, resolving certain kinds of things before you can do it. So one of the primary supporting conditions for samadhi is to be ethical, to live an ethical life, to live by the precepts, not to harm, not to steal, not to involve sexual misconduct, not to lie, not to be involved in intoxicating the mind. And this is, for some people, the bad news about samadhi. You know, but this is all good until now. What? This is a party pooper now. But the party just begins when you get samadhi. That's, you know, it's really good. And so, but the price for this deep sense of well-being, deep happiness, sometimes it's ecstatic, you know, deep rapture. It's not too uncommon for someone to come and say to a teacher like me, and people have done this to me, say, wow, the rapture, the ecstasy that I'm feeling in meditation when I really have strong samadhi, it's better than any orgasm I've ever had. Now, for some people, that says a lot. So there's a range of well-being, but it can be quite extreme sometimes. But the price is at being ethical. And some people really, it's necessary to clean up their ethics. And I've known people who could not enter into samadhi until they went and cleaned up certain things in their life. They either had to stop what they're doing, they had to ask forgiveness with someone, they had to atone for something they did. You have to somehow settle your ethical life if you expect to go really far in the world of meditation. And the reason for that is that the motivation and the movement in the mind to be unethical involves a split in the mind, involves a level of agitation and clinging, which is antithetical with samadhi, which is relaxation and unification, integration, everything working together. So cultivating ethical life so that you feel good about your ethics. And that's another supporting condition of samadhi, is to take the time to feel good about yourself because of your ethics. And one of the classic instructions is someone will say, well, I can't feel good about my ethics because I did all these terrible things in my life. And well, then feel good about yourself from the time you stopped doing those. From the time that you stopped lying and stealing and doing all these things, from that time, avail yourself of well-being. Appreciate yourself for that. Value that. Feel good about yourself for the fact that now you know that you're reliably not causing intentional harm to anyone. This is a really meaningful thing to do. And there's a lot of people who find that's very hard because, again, it feels self-centered. You're not supposed to feel good about yourself. If you're really ethical, you're supposed to just kind of not count. But in Buddhist spirituality, feeling good about yourself for your ethical behavior, for your good qualities, is part of the healthy self-regard that leads to the end of selfishness, leads to the end of certain kind of clinging to self. So that's another supporting condition for samadhi, is to begin feeling good about yourself. And so living an ethical life is one of the primary ways to do that. So first you have to live an ethical life, and then take the time to feel good about it. Some people find the second one harder than the first. But it's, and or it doesn't occur to them. Or sometimes when people are living a kind of ethical life, sometimes they'll take it so much for granted that they don't think that it's important. That's not good enough. You know, if I was really ethical, I would be Mother Teresa. If you, you know, if you're committed to not lying, really committed to not lying, or really committed to not harming any beings, or really committed to not drinking even alcohol, you are, it's an amazing gift that you're giving to other people. It's a beautiful thing to do. It's a profound thing to do. You can just get into almost any daily newspaper and read stories of people who have broken the precepts and how the devastation that's created around them. To feel good about yourself for what you don't do, because it's a gift, it's a support to our community. So this finding a way to feel good about oneself is good. Another way it's connected to ethics in Buddhism is to practice generosity, to give to others, but either whether it's your smile or you're asking how they are or your time or you're giving, you know, bringing a gift, bringing, you know, offering a meal to someone, and making donations places. But to practice generosity, and part of the function in Buddhism for practicing generosity, a number of reasons for practicing generosity, but one of the important reasons for people who are interested in samadhi is to, again, cultivate the sense of well-being. So when you sit down, you sit down in an atmosphere of feeling good about yourself, as opposed to sitting down in an atmosphere where you're not good enough, or you're wrong, or bad, or something. So these are supporting conditions, and relaxation, and ethics, and integration. There are other supporting conditions, but these are kind of the two, I think, big ones that I think of. So those are my kind of introductory talk to this series. So for next week, and then I'll skip a week, and then in 3 weeks I'll give a talk on continue the series on samadhi, and the last thing that occurs to me to say about samadhi is with samadhi you can fly. It just, you know, it just feels so wonderful to have this, and it's something that really can make a big difference in daily life, to cultivate this sense of stability, concentration, focus, to be here, and to feel the value of it and the joy of it and the benefits of it, makes it, to really know that, makes it compelling to do it more of it, and hopefully so much more compelling than the other things your mind has in mind. And at least some of you, I'm pretty confident, some of the time, would be better off having your mind concentrating than some of the other things that you do. So please consider this, you know, maybe consider this topic, and I'll continue next week. Thank you.